Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 844, interview with Peter Lavenda number 7 about the Hitler legacy. And this is being recorded on April 19th of the year 2015, the 20th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. And once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Peter Lavenda, the author of, among other books, The Hitler Legacy, which is the focal point of these interviews. Peter, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here as always.
Let's plunge right into the subject at hand. As I've mentioned in our past interviews, I'm very, very excited about this book and very grateful to you for having published it, because so many of the things that you speak about are things that I have been talking about episodically for decades, and yet here they are between one set of covers. And so it is very gratifying to me to be able to point listeners in the direction of a single text that covers so many of the things that I have been trying to communicate over the years. And at the end of the talk, I will once again make a suggestion about what people can do. One of the things, however, that you spent a lot of time on was something that I did not know about at all, and that is the profound Nazi presence in South and Southeast Asia prior to, during, and after World War II. And I'd like to turn to that in this interview. One of the major focal points of the lines of argument you present in the Hitler legacy is Indonesia. And I'd like to start by talking about some of the background, Indonesia as a Dutch colony and the nascent Dutch Nazi Party, both in the Netherlands and in Indonesia.
Certainly, I'd be happy to. I think that people in general may be a little bit surprised at some of this information. We are used to compartmentalizing everything, and especially when it comes to World War II, our historians tend to compartmentalize as well. So you have people who specialize in the European theater of conflict. You have those who specialize in the wars in Asia Pacific, without actually drawing connections between the two. And this is something that I've been guilty of, but I think most people have, if they've been brought up in this country, in the United States, with history classes being what they are. They're lucky they discuss that war at all. And if they do, it's, well, there was the war in Europe and there was the war in the Pacific. But there actually were points of tangents between the two. And they're usually dismissed by historians because they're sort of footnotes to the overall story. So when we discuss World War II, we're mostly focused on the Japanese invasions of all the various countries in that part of the world, Korea, China, and then all the way down into Southeast Asia. The Nazi presence there, if it's noticed at all, is usually relegated to a kind of footnote. And yet, in the context of the post-World War II environment, what was going on in Southeast Asia, as far as the Nazi presence is concerned, is extremely important. We discussed last time the idea that Carl Friedrich von Durkheim was in Japan as the head of the Gestapo in Japan, and at the same time he was a specialist in Zen Buddhism. And D.T. Suzuki, of course, was very impressed by what he saw of the Nazis, of Nazi Germany, and considered that they were sort of a template for what he wanted to do as far as the Japanese warriors on the mainland in China during their invasion. So there is a definite ideological connection. They were allies during the war to a certain extent. When we talk about the Japanese in World War II, we talk about the invasions they conducted. It was under the guise of being a liberation movement. The Japanese were in Southeast Asia to liberate those countries from their colonial masters. That means that when they invaded Malaya and Singapore, it was to liberate them from the British. And when they invaded Indonesia, it was to liberate them from the Dutch. The Philippines, to liberate them from the Americans, et cetera, et cetera. So this was the banner under which they invaded these countries, and it was very duplicitous. It was they really were not looking out for the best interests of those countries. They basically raped the countryside, took all of the art, the money, whatever they could find, just as the Nazis had been doing in the occupied territories in Europe, the Japanese were doing in Southeast Asia. And that's going to lend itself to the discussions that we're going to have in the next interview or two. Indonesia was the Netherlands' largest, most important colony. They were rich, or still rich, in things like rubber and other raw materials, and they contributed greatly to the war effort eventually. At the time in the 1930s, when the Dutch were still very powerful in Indonesia, we had the presence of a Nazi party in that country. This is something that's not very well known. You really have to search to find information like this, because who would expect there would be a Nazi party apparatus so far away from the motherland, or the fatherland in this case? And yet it was. The Nazi party apparatus in Indonesia was set up by a man called Walter Havel, who was a German. But there was already a ripe environment for Nazism and fascism in Indonesia, because the Netherlands was a hotbed of fascist sympathies. There was a Dutch Nazi party apparatus that was very pro-Nazi. There was another Dutch Nazi party apparatus that was, while being pro-Nazi, was very nationalistic as far as the Netherlands was concerned. So there were two factions, both fascist, in the Netherlands, both fighting each other for ascendancy. When the Germans finally did invade the Netherlands, one party, the pro-Nazi, pro-German party, won out, and the strictly Dutch nationalist party was given sort of second-class status. But there was a very strong Nazi party in the Netherlands. The Netherlands is a country that we all know from the history books and from the movies was the country where Anne Frank was hiding in the attic room of a house in Amsterdam. You can visit that house today in Amsterdam. She was one of the last people to be evacuated by train to the death camps. And when that had happened, the Governor General of the Netherlands pronounced to Hitler that the Netherlands, the entire country of the Netherlands, was Judenfrei, free of Jews.
Peter, just one second. The Nazi party, not the pro-nationalist party, was that the NSB?
That's right. There was the National Socialist Movement, which is the NSB.
Very good.
I could probably go into more detail. It was founded in 1931 in the city of Utrecht, which is very close to Amsterdam. Anton Mussert was the founder of that. He idolized the black shirts, the fascist movements in Italy under Mussolini, and he wanted to create this kind of a Dutch nationalist movement, National Socialist Movement of the Netherlands. But Mussert then became kind of second to some of the other leadership in the Netherlands. He wasn't the strongest member, but he was one of the most corrupt. When the dust had cleared after the war, it seemed that he was a very wealthy man. A lot of the money that he got was from confiscating Jewish businesses, Jewish antiquities, stealing them from museums and all the rest of it. He owned several companies by the time the war was over. So you had the NSB, the National Socialist Party of Movement of the Netherlands. It was not particularly anti-Semitic at first. It was very nationalist, but eventually did become extremely anti-Semitic. It collaborated completely with Seyss Inquart, who was the Governor General of the Netherlands under the Reich, in identifying, locating, and removing Jewish people from that country. When the dust had settled, the Netherlands probably was the most active in ridding its borders of Jewish people than any other country during World War II. It also had the largest percentage of its population join the SS. So there was a very strong pro-Nazi sentiment among the Dutch. The problem is, of course, the Nazis invaded the Netherlands. So now you had Dutch people living in Indonesia who were controlling that country as a colony for the Netherlands. And now it shakes out into two different directions. You have some Dutch who are anti-Nazi because their country had been invaded and they did not have Nazi sympathies. And then you had the Dutch who were Nazis. And that brings us to, of course, Walter Havel. Walter Havel was one of the youngest members of Hitler's entourage at the time of the Beer Hall Putsch in 1923, when Adolf Hitler attempted to take over the country and failed. Havel was virtually a teenager at that time. He marched alongside Heinrich Himmler, during the Beer Hall Putsch. He was arrested and thrown into Landsberg prison, along with Hitler and several of his other followers, such as Rudolf Hess. Havel was released after about a year. He went to Great Britain. He went to England to study business, to study trade. He made contact with British fascist organizations there under the advice of Rudolf Hess. And then, about a year after that, Walter Havel moves to Indonesia, where he becomes involved in the tea trade, among other things. He's in Indonesia for 10 years, 10 solid years in that country. And during that time, he sets up Nazi Party chapters in all of Indonesia's major cities. And we're talking about Jakarta, of course, Surabaya, everywhere in Indonesia that had any kind of a European expatriate community, particularly German or Dutch. Havel set up a Nazi Party apparatus. When war actually came and the Japanese invaded Indonesia, they found that the Nazi Party apparatus was already there. They found there was a Gestapo organization in Indonesia and that they were already busy trying to round up Jewish people wherever they could find them and send them to camps in Indonesia. So there was a very strong presence there for during the entire 1930s, the late 1920s to the early 1930s. And then, of course, when war broke out, then the Nazi Party organs in Indonesia became much more prominent, much more powerful. Walter Havel was called back to Germany once Hitler ascended to power in 1933. Havel was called back to join Hitler's government. Hitler always had fond memories of Walter Havel. And now Havel comes back to Europe with 10 years worth of stories about Indonesia. He becomes known as Surabaya Wali. Surabaya is the name of a very large seaport city in the north coast of Java in Indonesia. He lived for a long time in Surabaya, but in other places as well in Indonesia. And he came back and started telling all these wonderful stories about life in Indonesia. He was known for that. Hitler kept him pretty close at hand. Havel was seconded to the foreign ministry under Ribbentrop, Joachim von Ribbentrop, but actually Havel had much more access to Hitler than Ribbentrop did. Hitler basically lived with Hitler in the bunker when that was set up. For a while, however, he was a minister without portfolio. He lived in Spain for a while, which is a very important country, as we know, as far as the rat lines are concerned and the post-war Nazi underground. It's Franco-Spain, Franco, of course, being very pro-fascist, very pro-Nazi. Havel then moved from Spain to Germany, where he stayed at Hitler's right hand for the duration of the war. If you were involved in foreign policy, if you wanted Hitler's ear on something, you went to Havel. Havel would then pass the information on to Hitler. He was so powerful in that regard that Ernst Kaltenbrunner, second in command to Himmler of the SS, and later head of the SS once Himmler was fired at the end of the war, Kaltenbrunner told the Allied interrogators that if you wanted anything done where foreign policy issues were concerned, you sent the memo to Havel and Havel would pass it on to Hitler. You did not go through Ribbentrop, who was considered something of a joke. So Havel was extremely important in this regard, and he was one of the last people to see Hitler alive in the bunker. He did not leave the bunker until around the time of Hitler's alleged suicide in the bunker. Havel then disappears from sight completely. There are stories that he committed suicide, that he was killed during the Russian invasion of Berlin. We don't know. His body's never been found. There's never been any actual evidence to show what happened to Havel. But Havel was an important part of this story because he demonstrates the extent to which the Nazi Party had connections and networks in Southeast Asia, in particular in Indonesia. But there was another aspect to all of this as well, which is the logistical aspect of it, of the war, in that the Nazis actually had U-boat stations in Southeast Asia. And this is something else that you'll find only mentioned. If you find it mentioned at all, it will be in footnotes. It will not be examined at any great length by regular historians because it's no one sees the context of it. But there was a great deal of U-boat traffic from Europe through to South America, but also from South America into the Indian Ocean. There were refueling stations in the Indian Ocean for Nazi U-boats, and then there was a refueling center in Malaya, also at Singapore under Japanese control. And then when the British were busy taking back Malaya and Singapore, the refueling stations moved over to Indonesia, to Jakarta and to Surabaya, among other places. So you had a lot of U-boat traffic as well going into Indonesia. All of this becomes relevant as we discuss this later on, because when we discuss the Nazi underground after the war, we find that an entire apparatus is being set up to support this underground. And part of it is due to the Nazi U-boat traffic. It's a very strange story. There's photographs of it. There's some video of it, in case anyone finds this to be hard to believe. But a lot of Nazi U-boats did go in that direction. Mostly they were not designed for warfare. They were designed as cargo ships. They were bringing much-needed raw materials and technical expertise to the Japanese from the European side, and they were bringing back much-needed raw materials from the Asian side back to Europe to assist in the war effort. And this traffic went on right until the end of the war. Even when Germany had surrendered in May of 1945, there were Nazi U-boats in the Indian Ocean and in the region around Indonesia, which were then basically confiscated by the Japanese, who were still conducting a war in that part of the world. And the German U-boat commanders and personnel were basically stranded in Indonesia. There is a cemetery south of Jakarta that is a U-boat cemetery. Basically, it's a cemetery for the Nazi U-boat personnel who died in Indonesia. You can go there to visit their graves. There are Iron Cross statues there, Iron Cross statuary over the graves, as well as some statues of Buddha and of Hindu deities as well. So it's sort of a multi-ethnic, multi-religious cemetery, but it's all dedicated to the Nazi U-boat captains and their crew who died in Indonesia, who were not, who'd never made it back to Europe. One of the personnel who did make it back to Europe after the end of the war, one of those who sailed on the Nazi U-boats into Southeast Asia, who was part of that whole operation, later became a technical advisor for the film Das Boot, the very famous film about the German U-boat, life on a German U-boat during World War II. He became technical advisor to that film. But perhaps more interesting is who gave the land for that German U-boat crew cemetery. And, of course, that brings us back to a Neil Hilferich, who was one of Hitler's inner circle, who was a member of the Freundeskreis Himmler, which was the circle of friends around Himmler raising money for the Third Reich. He was one of those who signed a petition to have Hitler named Chancellor of Germany. Here's a person who had tremendous influence in the origins, the beginnings of Nazi Germany, in the 1920s and the 1930s, who was a major landowner and tea trader in Indonesia. Now, obviously would have been well known to Walter Havel as well.
Peter, interrupting very briefly, wasn't he also Helfrich, the fellow who was affiliated with Standard Oil?
Absolutely.
Right.
This was a person who had tremendous influence in very many corporations. He was on the board of several companies, and Standard Oil was one of them. Which, of course, opens up a whole can of worms, doesn't it? Now you have Standard Oil, you have Hilferich, you have Indonesia, you have Hitler, you have the U-boats, you have one person who's at the nexus of all of these various influences. This is something that, again, as I was doing the research, sort of boggled my mind, because this is history one never really comes across in the normal course of events. We certainly don't hear about this where the major industrial corporations are concerned. We sort of understand that there were American corporations involved with Nazi Germany, with financing them, starting with, of course, Henry Ford and Ford Motor Company, Henry Ford making donations to the Nazi Party back as early as the 1920s. We know about IBM to a certain extent, but here we have Hilferich, who is on the board of directors of Standard Oil, the company that would become Standard Oil, who is, helping to finance the Third Reich, helping to support Hitler, making sure Hitler is named Chancellor of Germany, and using his land to bury U-boat crews in Indonesia. This connection between Indonesia and Hitler and the Third Reich is very strong, and it's something that no one really talks about, especially not the Indonesian government. And from their point of view, it's also a footnote to history. But yet from our point of view, when we discuss the post-war Nazi underground, this is extremely important. So you have this strange nexus of individuals so close to Hitler, Walter Havel, who marched in the Beer Hall Putsch, who stayed with Hitler till the bitter end. You have Emil Hilferich, who not only is CEO, on the board of directors, rather, of Standard Oil, but also financing Hitler and ensuring that Hitler is named Chancellor of Germany, and very involved with the Nazi U-boat traffic to Indonesia. How is all this possible? You know, when you start looking at the connections between these individuals, these companies, these corporations, and the Nazi Party, it does boggle the mind. And these are not, this is not just guilt by association, which is a bugaboo of, you know, conspiracy theorists, for instance. This is not false equivalencies. These are people who are genuinely, intimately involved with the Third Reich and with Hitler personally.
It's association by guilt.
Yes, exactly. That's very good. I like that. It's association by guilt, exactly. And this is these are the people who set this up, and is it any wonder that at the end of the war you have all of these stories about a possible Hitler escape to Asia? You have an entire an American squad of soldiers scouring Japan looking for Hitler, thinking that Hitler had escaped there months and months and months after the end of the war. You have all of these rumors, and then, of course, you have all the missing gold, which will take us to another whole subject entirely. But before we do, we probably want to talk about some of the American involvement where Indonesia is concerned.
Before that, Peter, somebody that we're going to be talking about later in this program and also next week, and that is former Indonesian President Sukarno, who actually initially networked with and celebrated the Axis conquest because he saw that as an antidote to Dutch colonialism. However, he was more of an opportunistic nationalist, and we'll talk about some of the people who whose wrath he incurred and why later on. But I wonder if you would highlight that quickly for us.
Certainly. Sukarno, of course, is famous for the man who was running Indonesia in the 1950s and 1960s. His famous black cap and his sort of toothy smile, I think, was known in a lot of newsreels and a lot of photography during that period. Sukarno was one of the nationalist leaders who opposed Dutch presence in Indonesia. He was leading parties and movements of rebellion against the Dutch. When the Japanese finally did invade Indonesia, they targeted Sukarno as one of the leaders that they could work with because he was so anti-Dutch. And Sukarno saw that the Japanese were possible liberators. They were going to help rid the country of the Dutch. He was in Tokyo making radio broadcasts and speeches praising the Japanese and praising Hitler, saying that Hitler and the Third Reich would be at the very apex of nations at the end of the war, that you know, Hitler and the Japanese were going to liberate all of the oppressed peoples around the world. The Japanese also, it should be understood, made a lot of promises to Sukarno and to Hatta, who was the second, who became the vice president under Sukarno, and to the political parties there, saying that they would get their independence. The Japanese were not going to stay in Indonesia very long. They were only there to get rid of the foreign powers in Asia. They were going to return to Japan and give Indonesia back to the Indonesians. So it was on the basis of this promise that Sukarno worked with the Japanese during the war, which would have made him a Nazi and a fascist, right? But then after the war is over, but the civil war starts, basically, a war of liberation in Indonesia, the Dutch return. It should be remembered that at the Yalta Conference, the colonial powers were assured they would get their colonies back. This is something that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the president at the time, had grave misgivings about and recorded these misgivings and was extremely dissatisfied with this. He thought this was probably the wrong way to go. But it was very hard for him to go up against all of the other nations whose assistance that was needed to put an end to the war. So basically the French were told they were going to get Vietnam back. They were going to get back Indochina. The British were told they would get Malaya back in Singapore, and the Dutch were told they would get back Indonesia. So these promises were made. They were very well known, and so there was this tremendous resistance by Sukarno and by others with him in Indonesia to get rid of first the Dutch and then any other foreign presence that might be there. When the war was over, from 1945 till about 1950, the Indonesians were fighting a war of liberation because the Dutch had returned and they were trying to hold on to their colony. That didn't work. It was already, the die had been cast, and the Dutch only had a few more years left in Indonesia before they had to leave. They were forced out, and in 1948, independence was declared, but it really wasn't in effect until about 1950. Sukarno becomes their first president It's not really an elected position, but he becomes their president through acclaim, and he's running the country now from 1950 until he's finally deposed in about 1965, the year of Living Dangerously.
In connection with Sukarno, as his politics develop and as conspiratorial aspects of what took place in Indonesia develop, we should mention some, I think it would be fair to classify them as fascist American officers, all of them affiliated with the MacArthur Group in the military, Messrs. Willoughby, Walker, Del Valle, and Van Horn Moseley. I wonder if you would first encapsulate those individuals, and then Charles Willoughby, when testifying before the House Un-American Activities Committee, actually proposed something that we had already spoken about in earlier talks, that weaponized Islam, so to speak, be used as an anti-communist barrier, however, this one in Asia and against the communist Chinese. So first, Willoughby, Walker, Del Valle, and Van Horn Moseley, and then Willoughby's advocacy of weaponized Islam in Indonesia.
Certainly. I think what a lot of people don't remember, even people of my generation, is that in the 1950s and 1960s, the Cold War was such that you had a lot of very right-wing military commanders who were very open about their position where communism was concerned, but also very tolerant of the extreme right or of Nazism for the most part. And this group around MacArthur, for instance, was well known at the time. Charles Willoughby, of course, we'll get back to in more detail when we get into the story, but he was referred to by MacArthur as his pet fascist. Actually, Willoughby wasn't born Willoughby. He was a German. He was born Adolf Karl Cheppe Weidenbach. He was born in Heidelberg. His mother was American from Baltimore, but his father was German. They came back to the United States, and the rest is history, as they say. We'll get back to that a little bit later. There was also Major General Edwin Walker. Walker was the general that Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly tried to assassinate in the days before the assassination of President Kennedy. He was so right-wing, he accused Truman of being a communist. This was something that was very common during the 1930s and 40s. Of course, the right-wing accused President Roosevelt of being a communist constantly. And then when Roosevelt died and Truman took over, he was the vice president and he became president, he was accused of being a communist. This was the man who authorized dropping atomic bombs in Japan, but anyway, he was accused of being a communist. Another general, of course, was Pedro del Valle. He was the first Hispanic or Latino general of the Marines, highly decorated veteran of World War II, fought in the Pacific. But he has a very strange background as well. He wound up working for ITT in Cairo at about 1948. And what is interesting there, of course, is that ITT had a very strong presence in Nazi Germany during the war. In fact, one of the heads of German counterintelligence, Walter Schellenberg, was on the board of directors of ITT throughout World War II. And now in 1948, we have Pedro del Valle working for ITT as representative in Cairo. When it got too hot in Cairo, because there was the revolts taking place between the Muslim Brotherhood and you had Nasser rising to power and all the rest of it, he left and began working for ITT in South America. He was in Buenos Aires during the regime of Juan Perón, which means he was in Argentina at the time when the Nazi underground was at its most prominent, and working to set up their own operations in Argentina everywhere, not just in Buenos Aires, but throughout the country. So he has a very suspicious background. Then there's General George Van Horn Moseley. He was another very right-wing, anti-Semitic general. He retired before the war started in 1938, but one of his major platforms, one of his political agendas was that he felt that the refugees who were fleeing Europe, by refugees, the code word here is the Jews, that they should be sterilized before they were allowed to enter the United States. Mosley was afraid that the people coming in who were escaping Nazi Germany and were escaping the conflicts there would pollute the gene pool in the United States, that their genetic material was substandard, which of course is the Nazi ideal. He thought that Roosevelt was a communist again, that Roosevelt was a kind of a dictator. He thought that Nazism would help protect the United States against Jewish and communist domination in the country. So we had all of these really crazy people, and they were all general staff. I mean, they were all generals in the military, in the United States military, and they had extreme Nazi positions on these things. So we go back briefly to General Willoughby. Willoughby, among other things, was MacArthur's chief of military intelligence during World War II. As I said, MacArthur referred to him as his pet fascist. He was also head of military intelligence during the Korean War. And then he became involved with pro-nationalist groups in Japan at the time, actually raising money to support these pro-nationalist groups in Japan. The money, of course, the source of that money, we'll get into it, I think, in a later interview, but we're talking about, of course, the gold that had been stolen by the Japanese and also by the Nazis. So that's a whole other story. But he was involved with that. He was involved in working as a consultant to General Franco in Spain. He was involved in a lot of anti-Christian groups, anti-communist groups who were Christian crusade-type organizations, like the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, which was a front, basically, organization founded by H.L. Hunt, the oil magnate. So you have Willoughby, a very outspoken general, someone who had been born in Germany, whose first name actually was Adolf, who even MacArthur considered was a fascist. We have this man then speaking before the House Un-American Activities Committee in the 1950s. He's making a statement. You can read this in Hitler Legacy, but there's also, you can find this documentation elsewhere. If you search hard enough, you will find his testimony. He gave a testimony before this committee because he was concerned about the rise of communism in the United States, but he singled out Indonesia specifically as a place where communism was in danger of taking over the country. He felt that Sukarno had turned from being this fascist who had made speeches in Japan during the war to now becoming a communist. It should be noted that even the OSS, the forerunner to the CIA, even OSS agents reported back to Washington that Sukarno was hardly a fascist or a communist. He was an opportunist. He was a nationalist in terms of Indonesia, but he wasn't anti-Semitic. Of course, there were virtually no Jews in Indonesia to speak of. He was not, he didn't believe in this worldwide Jewish Masonic conspiracy to rule the world. He just wanted to get rid of foreign powers out of Indonesia. He would work with whomever, whenever it was likely to do so. To Willoughby, Sukarno had gone from being a nationalist and a fascist to sort of sucking up to the communist influences. And this is as a result of something that happened in 1955. It's called the Bandung Conference. It's too complex a situation to discuss at any great length, but suffice it to say, this was a pan-Asian or a pan third world conference, you might say, in the days when we called developing nations the third world. This was a meeting of the non-aligned nations. In other words, people who did not want to be on the side of the United States or on the side of the Soviet Union, and what they saw was a war between two superpowers. They wanted out of that conflict. They wanted to create an alternative. Sukarno was very vocal in trying to supply that alternative, and they offered Indonesia as the place where all of these countries could gather together and meet to discuss this. Attending this meeting were the Chinese, among others, but a lot of people from Latin America, from Southeast Asia, from Africa, attended this conference because they were looking at themselves as a third way, as another option, not United States capitalism, not Soviet Union-style communism, but something that would be appropriate for their own countries. And in order to do this, Sukarno also floated the idea of an alternative to the World Bank, something that would not have to deal with the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, or the World Bank, and the demands being made by European powers, but something that they could pool their own resources together and create their own bank. And, of course, this was a major threat to Western ideas as to what should be done in Southeast Asia. And it pushed Sukarno really more and more towards the communists. Sukarno was looking more and more like someone, if he wasn't for the United States and for capitalism, well, then he had to be a communist. And that was the idea in those days. It was a very polarized environment. So you have Willoughby now raising this flag and saying, Sukarno's a communist, Indonesia's in danger of going communist, we should throw all of our resources behind the Muslim parties in Indonesia, use Islam to form a buffer against China. In other words, create a kind of caliphate of Muslim parties and political entities in Southeast Asia, use their religion to protect, not really protect Indonesia, but protect Australia and New Zealand from any kind of incursion from China. So the idea was to create this buffer zone, and he refers to it that way, as a kind of crescent that would go from about Thailand all the way down through Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, the Philippines, and use the Islamic parties to do this. This is exactly the same as what was being discussed about using Islamic parties in Europe to fight the Soviet Union. And here is Willoughby then discussing and raising this idea that we should weaponize Islam against the communists.
Something to remember, and perhaps this is an important, this would be a good place to remind people of that Indonesia is not only the most populous Muslim country on earth, but it also is very, very important in terms of natural resources, and both rubber, for example, and what the Kazakhs call the devil's tears, oil, are very much present in Indonesia. I thought it was interesting that Emil Helfrich was associated with Standard Oil because both rubber and oil were major focal points of some of the cartel agreements between IG Farben and Standard Oil. So when Willoughby is contemplating Indonesia going communist, and when some of his associates are contemplating Indonesia going communist, this is an area that is not only very populous in terms of Muslim population, but is a key element in terms of natural resources as well. Sukarno had this idea of building an alternative to the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, as you mentioned. By the way, even as we speak, China is developing something like that, and the U.S. is very much up in arms over the willingness of its European allies to associate themselves with this bank. But you know, when we talk about strange political bedfellows, I don't think we could find a more striking example of that than Sukarno and Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, whom we had spoken about before. I guess you could say Sukarno was shocked. could you detail that for us, and how Hjalmar Schacht and his post-war role as a distributor of Nazi monies, and perhaps also his affiliation with Otto Skorzeny, about whom we have spoken, how do Sukarno and Hjalmar Schacht figure into the designs for a third financial way, so to speak?
Well, it is one of those things that you just can't make up this stuff. I mean, truth being stranger than fiction, certainly in this case, every event that we're covering is stranger than fiction. And the idea of Hjalmar Schacht being in Indonesia advising Sukarno as early as 1951 is one of those bizarre things that you would never believe was possible. Schacht, as we remember from previous interviews, was known as Hitler's banker. Schacht was the person who oversaw the financial underpinnings of the Third Reich. He made sure that Germany was rearmed, even though there were laws against it, and even though there was a tremendous financial debt that Germany had in war reparations from World War I. None of that made any difference to Hjalmar Schacht. Schacht managed to create all sorts of financial instruments to cover up what he was doing as far as rearming Germany, and of course was instrumental in getting Hitler named chancellor along with Hilferich and all the others. So Hjalmar Schacht is one of those people who was brilliant when it came to financing, on the one hand, and on the other hand, he was a dedicated Nazi and a dedicated anti-Semite, something that he tried to play down, of course, during the Nuremberg trials. The Russians wanted to hang him for war crimes, but he managed to skate because at one point Martin Bormann wanted to remove Schacht, at least the influence of Schacht over Hitler, and came up with some story that Schacht should be sent to a camp or something, and he was briefly imprisoned, and because of that, the Allies basically let him go. So here's Schacht. In 1951, in Jakarta, in Indonesia, working as an advisor to Sukarno. And what he's advising to Sukarno is the same thing that Willoughby would discuss 6-7 years later when he's talking in front of the House on American Activities Committee. Schacht is telling Sukarno to build a buffer, build an Islamic buffer, a crescent, a new caliphate in Southeast Asia. And in order to do this, it was advising Sukarno on how to set up finances and discussing about monetary arrangements with the new country of Indonesia. Now, we have to kind of backpedal a little bit to understand what this is all about and what Schacht is really talking about. Schacht was one of the people who invented the Bank of International Settlements, BIS. We've talked about them before. This was the bank that was operating out of Switzerland. During the war, its president was an American, and yet they were heavily involved in laundering money for the Third Reich. And a lot of that money, gold, valuables of other kinds, wound up in Switzerland and then in other countries around the world, Spain, Portugal, Latin America, and Southeast Asia. So Schacht knew where all of this money was. Schacht knew where the accounts were. Schacht knew how to gain access to these accounts. And now in 51, he's advising Sukarno and giving Sukarno this idea about creating another bank, another type of financial institution that would compete basically with the BIS that Schacht had invented and created in Switzerland in the years just before the war, or perhaps operating in concert with BIS. We don't know all of the subjects that were discussed with Sukarno. We just know that Schacht was there advising Sukarno on what he should do, and that by 1955, Sukarno has this idea of creating what he calls the Revolutionary Fund. Now, I should point out something again, for listeners may remember, that in our previous interview, we discussed the fact that 40 tons of Nazi gold, of Reichsbank gold, made its way by submarine from Portugal to Macau. And of those 40 tons of gold, 20 tons went into China, ostensibly, I was supposed to help prop up the efforts by Chiang Kai-shek to defeat Mao's communist forces. And another 20 tons of that gold wound up in Indonesia, specifically in Indonesia, 20 tons of Nazi gold, which might have only been a drop in the bucket as far as Sukarno was concerned, but it would have formed the nucleus of a new fund, a new banking system, the Revolutionary Fund, as Sukarno called it. You may think this is a little far-fetched, except that in the 1980s, the Singaporean newspapers were full, and the Malaysian and Indonesian newspapers were full of stories of this particular fund, because someone who had been imprisoned after the fall of Sukarno, one of his ministers, admitted the existence of this fund and knew where it was and knew where the money was and how to get at it. The story briefly surfaced in the newspapers. Names were named, dates, places, and everything else. And then suddenly the story dropped out of sight. Nothing was heard about it again, except that the leader of the Indonesia's most powerful political party also went on the record as admitting, yes, the Revolutionary Fund existed, and it was mysteriously had disappeared once Sukarno was removed from power. So Schacht is in Indonesia advising Sukarno, but that's not all. Schacht is going around the world advising military dictators everywhere. Schacht still has his own political ideology, his own political allegiances, and he's very closely involved with Otto Skorzeny. Otto Skorzeny, as we recall, is running Odessa. He's running basically the Nazi underground, hand in glove with Hans Ulrich Rudel. But also, he's actually married to someone who worked for Schacht during the war, Schacht's personal secretary. He's actually practically part of Schacht's family. In fact, some people have said he married a relative of Hallmar Schacht. I'm not sure if that's true. There's been some discussion over that. But at any rate, Skorzeny is very close to Schacht regardless. Skorzeny is so close to Schacht that he's an advisor to Schacht, and Shaka's an advisor to Skorzeny. They're working together to finance the Fourth Reich, you might call it. They're working together to finance the Nazi underground. And Skorzeny's involved in his machinations in North Africa and the Middle East and South America, using money coming out of the Swiss banks that he has access to, that Schock knows the account numbers and knows how to gain access to all of these blind accounts. Also, François Jeannot, as we mentioned previously, the Swiss financier, is also having access to these same accounts and supporting liberation movements in North Africa and the Middle East. Skorzeny's supporting them. Fascist sort of takeovers in Latin America, and now Schock is in Asia discussing these same ideas with people like Sukarno. So this is the story that we've been I've been following for the last few years. It's replete with all sorts of intrigues and impossible combinations of individuals. Kalmar Schock, of all people, is in Indonesia advising Sukarno on weaponizing Islam against communism and informing alternative banking institutions to go up against the American banking institutions and the Western, the World Bank and the IMF. This is incredible stuff. And it's all part of the story that we talk about, of course, in Hitler Legacy.
Something that also figures in, and I would like to perhaps talk about, say much of the discussion about Sukarno's gold till next week, but the Indonesia, by the way, I should stay, mention that, for many years, I have been accessing the remarkable work of Sterling and Peggy Seagraves and their book Gold Warriors, as well as its prequel, so to speak, the Yamato Dynasty. And Indonesia, in addition to being a focal point for Nazi gold transfers, is also appears to have been an area where many of the Golden Lily caches were also established. And I wonder if you would encapsulate Golden Lily and the work of the Seagraves, and also mention he has more names than God, I guess, Mr. Santo Romana, and his links with Opus Dei and the Catholic Church, and the Church's presence in South Asia in the context of what we have been speaking about.
Sure. I mean, this is a very detailed discussion, but I'll summarize the high points as best I can. We're talking about, of course, the Asian aspect of all of this. We talked about Nazi gold, but there's also, of course, the Japanese connection. The work of Sterling Seagrave is remarkable. I strongly recommend people read Gold Warriors, and not only that, but to access the DVD or the CD-ROM, really, that has a lot of documentation with it, which will help understand the scope of this situation. It has all of the transcripts and legal documents and everything concerning it. We're talking about you mentioned the role of the Catholic Church in all of this. One thing, again, historians seem to forget, when they do touch upon the fact that the Catholic Church was very involved in World War II to one extent or another, and they were particularly involved in helping Nazi war criminals escape justice and wind up in Latin America or wind up in Africa or Asia, other parts. What we tend to forget is that on the Asian side, the Catholic Church was very powerful as well. They were very powerful in the Philippines, of course, which is largely a Catholic country. And the role of Catholicism, the Catholic Church apparatus in Southeast Asia and in Asia generally during World War II has been overlooked. The motivation by the church to get involved in helping war criminals escape extended to Asia. And part of the reason why of this, of course, was because of the gold. There was a great deal of Japanese gold. Japanese generals were, as I said before, raping these countries. They were stealing everything that wasn't nailed down, just the way the Nazis were doing in the occupied territories. The same thing was happening in Asia. The Japanese were going through China like a buzzsaw, taking whatever they could find. Valuables, paintings, artwork, jewels, gold, most of that has never been recovered. Some of it is still in Japanese possession, in some cases in museums, in many cases in private ownership, in banks, in vaults, and scattered throughout Southeast Asia. There was a tremendous case, we can discuss this in more length, but there was a tremendous case in which some of this gold was discovered in the Philippines, one burial site out of more than 80 in the Philippines put there by the Japanese at the end of the war. One site alone was discovered, and this was the famous Golden Buddha hoard, which was a great deal of gold, jewels, bars of gold, what they call briquettes of gold, not the big bars but the small briquettes, just millions and millions and millions of dollars worth was discovered by some local Filipino treasure hunters. And then, of course, it was seized by Marcos, who was the dictator at the time. Of course, the anti-communist, very pro-fascist dictator, seized all of that, and a court case ensued. And decades later, the American courts found in favor of the Filipino workers who had found the gold and decided against the Marcos regime. The story has tentacles that leads everywhere. The work of the Seagraves is very important in this regard. But we have the Catholic Church involved in the Philippines also burying gold. What better place than churches which have underground vaults and catacombs and that sort of thing in the Philippines? A lot of gold was hidden there, and there were there's a lot of Catholic Church activity in making sure the gold stayed out of the hands of the Allies. They did not want the gold to fall in the hands of the communists, where China was concerned, but certainly not in the hands of the Allies either. They were looking towards nationalistic political motivations for this gold. They wanted the gold to be used for their purposes. It was their slush fund for various types of political operations and military operations in Asia. And most of that gold has not yet been recovered. It's still in either private possession. Nixon was involved in this fund. We can talk about this more at greater length because we're running out of time. But Willoughby was involved with this gold, General Willoughby, in financing Japanese political parties. And, of course, there was strong Catholic Church involvement. We can go back to Santa Romana, I think, in more detail when we have more time. But here was a person who was very involved in helping the Japanese hide gold and to move it around places all over Southeast Asia, including, of course, in Indonesia as well as the Philippines and all these remote islands that virtually no one ever goes to visit. For any reason, there's a lot of gold still hidden out there. There's records of Japanese U-boats in the vicinity at the end of the war when all was lost, crews burying things throughout the islands from the Indonesian archipelago up to the Philippines. So there's a story that remains to be told.
It is, I think, and we will go into Sukarno's gold and the maneuvering around that in our discussions next week. And again, I refer listeners to many programs that I have done about with the Seagraves. And once again, I think the book Gold Warriors and its prequel, the Yamato Dynasty, will supplement much of what we're talking about in connection with the Hitler legacy. As, by the way, will a formidable volume called Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaki and the Post-War Fascist International by Kevin Coogan. A stiff read, but a very worthwhile one. We've got about 5 minutes left, Peter, and looking ahead to some of the things that I would like to talk about next week. You mentioned that in one of the unsuccessful attempts at overthrowing Sukarno, a fellow by the name of Lee Harvey Oswald was allegedly involved. And next week I'd like to go into some of Lee Harvey Oswald's Nazi connections as well, something that does not get discussed at all. Tell us about Oswald and the abortive attempt to overthrow Sukarno.
Yes, this is one of the things that you're not going to hear in the history books either. In fact, George Tenet, head of the CIA at the time in the late 90s and early 2000s, had refused to declassify these records. The CIA attempted to overthrow Sukarno's government as early as 1958. Remember that we had Willoughby talking before the House Un-American Activities Committee on the communist threat coming from Indonesia. And around the same time, we had the CIA running operations in Indonesia to try to overthrow Sukarno, too. This is an incredible story, and it's one that is still mostly classified. There are a few people who have talked about this. Peter Dale Scott, an excellent historian, where this is concerned, has talked about it. He's one of the few people that does talk about it. But there was this attempt in 1958 by our own forces to do this. It was a CIA operation, but it involved thousands and thousands of American troops who were stationed in the Philippines, and Lee Harvey Oswald, of course, was stationed in the Philippines at that time. So we have every reason to believe that Oswald would have been part of this operation targeting Sukarno. I just want to point out that on a personal level, back in the 1980s, around 1984, 85, I met one of the people who was involved in that attempted overthrow of Sukarno. He was a submarine commander, actually, and he was involved in this in Indonesia in this particular conflict. And he said that he had been awarded a medal personally by President Kennedy. Once Kennedy became president, back in 1960-61, he was at a ceremony in which Kennedy gave him this sort of clandestine medal for his work in Indonesia in 58. The coup, of course, was not successful. CIA lost actually a bomber in the rainforest during this operation. Pilot was shot down. Some people were taken prisoner. And Sukarno was still firmly in power. But this was when it was believed that Sukarno was turning towards the left, that he was turning towards communist China as a supporter, and so the CIA attempted to get rid of him and put the generals in charge. This did not really happen until 65. And in 1965, of course, there was a successful military coup. It was the famous subject of the movie The Year of Living Dangerously, which is what Sukarno called 1965. He knew that the country was on the verge of a military coup, a military takeover. The Communist Party of Indonesia was poised to try to take over enough power in the country, and the consortium of generals decided they were going to stop it. Sukarno was basically put under house arrest, and General Suharto took over the country, and everybody on the right breathed a sigh of relief because that meant that the military was in charge of Indonesia and there would be no chance of a communist takeover. But in the process, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people were slaughtered in the name of defeating communism. People who had nothing to do, of course, with communism. People who were not members of the PKI, of the Communist Party of Indonesia. Still, it was a chance to settle old scores. And millions, probably more than a million, were slaughtered. Over 100,000 on the island of Bali alone at that time. So this is the environment in which we have Hjalmar Schacht, and we have Otto Skorzeny, and we have the CIA, and we have Nazi gold, Japanese gold, General Yamato's gold, and all the rest of it. This is the environment this is taking place. The war was between the right and the left, between fascism and communism. I don't like to think that it was the war between American-style democracy and communism. This was much more a case of putting dictators, ruthless dictators, in charge in Latin America, all over Latin America, and, of course, also in Southeast Asia and in Africa wherever possible. And that's part of the Hitler legacy.
And we will be going into this at greater length in the next couple of weeks. I hope we have whetted listeners' appetites. As I have said before, I'm very, very excited about the Hitler legacy and very grateful to you for having written and published a book that has so many of the topics that I have spoken about over decades. However, I have to cover these things episodically, and you have it all in one almost diabolic cornucopia. And listeners ask me, well, gee, I believe what you're saying, but I don't know what to do. This is something that they can do. They can buy this book, read it, and tell others about it. Peter, where can they get your book?
Thank you very much. Yes, you can get it, of course, at on Amazon. Amazon.com has it. Barnes & Noble is carrying it in their stores. And if you have any difficulty, of course, you can contact me through my own website, which is peterlavenda.com.
And this concludes For the Record program number 844, interview number 7 with Peter Lavenda about the Hitler legacy. This is being recorded on April 19th of the year 2015. For Peter Lavenda, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.